This episode of The Envelope is brought to you by Neon's Anora, winner of the Critics' Choice Best Picture, DGA Best Director, and PGA Best Producer Awards. This award season, the choice is simple. Follow your heart.
It is wild to me that while you've been promoting The Brutalist, been finishing The Brutalist, you and Mona Fastfold, your partner in life and filmmaking, have a whole other movie that you've also been working on, a musical about the Shakers. Like, how is that even possible?
Well, yeah, I left that part out. That's true.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Envelope. Kelvin Washington alongside the usual suspects. We had Yvonne Viriel, Mark Olson. Happy to be here with you as always. I'm going to start with you, Yvonne. Coralie Farge. The substance.
Wait, I want to start with you in this tie. Oh. I didn't notice it until now. Look at you.
Listen, it's just the little things. I'm glad you noticed it. You gave me a little emotional here. You know what? But I appreciate you noticing that. That means a lot to me. And I'm trying to just maintain my professionalism. And
why?
No, because, yeah.
Tell me what's the story.
I needed a pop at some point. So I went with the tie I haven't worn in like a year and a half, couple of years. So I was like, you know what? Bring that one on out.
Oh, when you said it was going to make you emotional.
No, you're made me emotional because I'm ready to talk movies and you made me talk a little fashion. Listen, you're actually going to have a dark-skinned brother turning purple. Blessing up. Let's get to the substance or the substance
well,
to fashion.
Well, appearance is everything, and as we learn with the substance.
That was smooth.
I try. So The Substance is a dark satire / body horror. It's up for 5 nominations. And it follows this, you know, actress turned fitness guru who's sort of past her prime, played by Demi Moore. And she's taken to this underground drug known as The Substance to sort of reclaim her youth. And it creates this younger, more perfect version of herself. And that version is played by Margaret Qualley. And throughout the course of the film, it's this battle of control over their lives. Do I want to stay who I am or do I want this perfect version? And it really is sort of a commentary on like the violence that we inflict on ourselves. And it was a poignant discussion with Coralie. I really enjoyed it.
I think we can all relate to that a little bit, especially with, you know, social media and kind of how we view ourselves or present ourselves.
Yes.
Swing over to you, Mark. You had Brady Corbet and The Brutalist.
That's right. Brady Corbet is really interesting. He was an actor as a teenager, transitioned to filmmaking, was his third feature film as a director. And, you know, barely 6 months ago, The Brutalist premiered at the Venice International Film Festival, didn't have a U.S. distributor, really caused a sensation there. He won the Best Director Prize, was picked up by the studio A24. They've put together this campaign and launched the film. It's now got 10 Academy Award nominations. I mean, it's kind of just an amazing just trajectory. And it's the story of a Hungarian immigrant and architect played by Adrian Brody comes to America after World War II and sort of what he encounters and just trying to like practice his art to find his way. And it's this just really dense, rich story about the immigrant experience, about ambition, about sort of artistic triumph and failure. It's just and Brady speaks about the movie with such passion and conviction. It's really an exciting conversation, I think.
And it's just such a large scale film too. We'll see how it does. All right, here is Yvonne with Coralie Farge of The Substance.
Coralie, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the film's 5 Oscar nominations. That's very impressive. The Substance has themes that have been with you for a long time, but it arrives, you know, in a growing celebrity worshiping culture, one where there's, you know, Ozempic, Botox obsession. What does that say to you about these themes that just never seem to go away?
That's exactly that. I think it's a different product, but same story. And unfortunately, I think everything you're speaking about like really shows how much those issues are still very much there. And the pressure, you know, of conforming to a certain ideal still tyrannizes in a way. For me, the movie is really about wanting to say that I'd like that we are freed from this jail, you know, to find our real freedom of doing what we want. You know, the idea of the movie is not to say you shouldn't do this or you shouldn't do that, but you should do whatever you want for yourself, but just because you want it. And I still think that there is still so much external pressure, you know, that made us think that we have no choice but changing ourselves to be acceptable or to be worse of, you know, being interesting. And to me, that's the real issue. So the movie was really about, yeah, trying to make a big kick in that system to say, let us be who we are and look at us for who we are, not the fantasized version, you know, that has been shaped since 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Was there a moment or an experience that sort of incited this idea for you? Was it something someone told you? Was it an inner thought you felt about yourself that led you to this project?
It was definitely an inner thought. When I had passed my 40s, I really started to have those crazy, violent thoughts that my life was going to be over. Like for me, okay, it's the end of being interested. It's the end of, you know, having any value in society. And the way this was so strong and hits me with so much violence, like questioned myself about how crazy this is, you know, hopefully I'm not at the middle of my life and already thinking that I'm done, that it's over. It really made realize that if I wasn't doing something with that, it could destroy me. And I think, in fact, it's a theme, you know, that lives with me since I'm a little girl, because the movie is not about just aging. It's about how you're supposed to look like and behave to conform to the idea that society has built of what it is to be a girl, what it is to be a woman. And a huge part of it has been, I think, defined through the eyes of men, you know, what a girl should be, what a woman should be, to be interesting in the eyes of men, to be desirable, you know, to be worshipped. And I think at different stage of my life, it has brought huge issues about feeling that if I wasn't into those boxes, I wasn't, you know, worth being in the world. So at each different stage of my life, it kind of tyrannized me, you know, in a way that if I don't look like that, I should look like that if I wanted to be, yeah, you know, someone could be interesting.
What is your earliest memory of that for you? Because I know, like, being 5 and playing with Barbies, I remember I have vivid memories of, like, being fixated on the waist of the Barbie and just, like, I'm like, that just doesn't seem real. And then as I, you know, as it gotten older, I was like, I need to be like Kimberly, the Pink Power Ranger. What do you remember about the earliest memories of that for you, of measuring yourself up to what's out there?
There was the Barbies, of course. There was also the fairy tales, you know, the Cinderella, blonde, thin, beautiful, you know, girl with this beautiful dress. And this at school, I remember, shaped a very precise idea of who was the beautiful girl and who wasn't, you know, the beautiful girl. And when I was a kid, I remember, you know, I had short, frizzy hair with glasses, and I wasn't at all, you know, like the model that was supposed to be those Barbies thing. And I remember, like, it's funny because I remember this now. Some guys were calling me monster, you know. So, you know, I think everything infused in a way that if you're out of the boxes of the representations that society creates for people, it brings a lot of violence. And as you say, I think in our generations, it was a very one way of defining, you know, who was worse of being called beautiful and who was worse called of being interested. And a bit later on, it was all those baby doll, you know, kind of Lolita symbols that kept shaping this kind of Barbie, you know, ideal that we grew up with.
Do you find yourself talking about these things a lot with your girlfriends?
Not so much, in fact. But not so much, yes. Because, and I do believe that it's still something that is very taboo, that, you know, many women kind of deal for themselves and we are used to kind of hide. And maybe we think about it, but we don't share it. I think there is still a massive fear of if we speak about that, we're going to be sidelined. Because it's always easier to be with a norm. It's always easier to be with what is the most popular, to what is the most, recognized. And so that's also the idea of the movie. I think there is so much that going on inside us internally that you are used to just keep with ourselves. And we go in society and we smile even when something makes us uncomfortable. You know, the number of time I had comments and you just smile because that's the way, you've been used to deal with things. You don't want to make problem. You don't want to, be the one that's going to be spotted. And I think it's a huge part of the human story that we don't hear, that we don't look at, that we don't listen. And the idea of the film was to say, look at that. Look at what we really go through. Look at who we really are. Look at our stories. Look at our inner fights.
Yeah.
Look at our complexity. And I wanted to make it all that explode, in the face of society so we finally see it.
It quite literally explodes.
Exactly.
Well, to that point, much like your first feature-length film, Revenge, The Substance is a very visceral and sensorial experience. The sounds that we hear, the shots and the frames, the framing of the shots and just the colors, there's a lot to take in and you feel it as you're watching it. And I'm curious what the pre-production is like for you. Are you just listening to a bunch of sounds? Like, what do I want the shrimp to sound like as Dennis Quaid is just munching? Walk me through the process for you.
Yeah, so exactly. As you say, all those things that you said, I know that they are the way for me to tell my stories. I start not with writing dialogues, but it really goes through visual, sound, and the visceral experience that you're going to feel because of the framings, because of the, macro shots, the inner sound that you hear, the relationship to the colors that suddenly pop or the location. All these combined together create a real experience that you enter, and that you feel. And so for me, it really starts from the writing, in fact. It's really from the writing that I find the world of the film and what those tools are going to be for that specific film to express what I want to say. So before I start writing or while I'm writing, yes, I'm listening to a lot of music, to a lot of sounds to find the identity, the vibe that I want to convey sound-wise. So I remember for this one, I listened to a lot of experimental musics, to a lot of music that were pulsative, almost as if they were coming from inside a body as a heartbeat. And this start to shape the kind of general sound identity that's really going to define the experience. And when I found, pieces that I love and that really inspire me, I start to write my scene listening to them. So they really kind of shape the rhythm while I'm writing. I'm really going with already some sound in my head. Also because as I edit, I really write the scene that I want to, shape at the end. And everything comes into account, like not only the shots, but also the pacing, the rhythm, the silence, or at the contrary, when the music, kind of explodes or become very rough. And all this, I need to shape it from a very, very early process, because I know that they're going to be the driving force of, building the scenes and the images. And it's the same for the visual and the colors. I research a lot of images. I build a very, very detailed, what I call a lookbook, which is visuals that I, same thing, start to create the identity of the film before, I start to work with my head of departments. So it goes from paintings to photographies, that's going to, same thing, that's going to give a vibe, you know, that's going to give something that you feel that start to shape the specific identity of the film.
Is there a source of inspiration that would surprise us either sound-wise or visual-wise?
No, I think it's things that, you know, I gather from a long time because, you know, when I, in my everyday life, when I see something that I like, I take a picture and I keep it somewhere. Or when I hear to a music that I like, same thing, I research it and I put it somewhere. And so I love to, you know, collect things that create a spark, a creative response in me. So because it means that there is something that resonates and then that can feed my own inspiration. Mm-hmm. And what I also love is I don't forbid myself to take inspiration in everything, in the classical paintings, let's say, or in the very pop culture, you know, modern images. I don't have any rules. I really take things for what they inspire me and the thing that feels relevant for the film, whatever it comes from. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be something I see on Instagram or it can be a painting I see in a museum. I don't limit myself to any specific thing.
There were so many moments in the film where, and I looked back at my notes just to confirm, even though I remember vividly, but where I just wrote, I want to see how this is written in the script. And I want to talk about the birth sequence in particular. It's such an arresting display of body horror and filmmaking magic. How did the idea of another human birthing out of Elizabeth sort of come to you? And what were those conversations like to achieve a moment like that for the screen?
So it's very interesting that you focus on that scene because, in fact, it's the very first scene that I wrote even before I knew who my character were going to be. Because for me, I think that scene is really defining the DNA of the whole film. You know, I think it has the relationship with the body, with the nudity, with what is your body for real when you look at it in the mirror, when it's heavy, laying down on the floor. Also, what you can feel inside of you, you know, as a growing experience that you don't see, but that can be very visceral. This scene has no dialogue at all. The only dialogue that there is when Sue is finally born and look at herself in the mirror and say, hello. It is the language of the film and of that scene goes through bodies, you know, goes through what the body experience, the relationship we have with our body, with our image, the sound. Also, this scene, I think, creates a very experimental relationship to the filmmaking, you know, with the tunnel of light, with all the POV, you know, relationship where you literally wake up in someone else's body as if you are experiencing yourself, the discovery, you know, of, okay, I'm not in my body anymore. I see the other body on the floor, what I'm going to discover. And you discover, you know, yourself in the mirror with this fantastic new appearance. And so that scene was the first idea, in fact. It was the first idea that sparked the substance, like having literally this fantasy of having a better version of yourself. The fantasy that we have, if I were like that, it would solve all my problems. You know, I would be happy. I would, you know, I wouldn't have any problem. To literally take shape for real, you know, to literally happen for real. It was the key scene, you know, that took us, I would say, like almost most of the time in prep and in shooting to achieve. Because it was a very technical scene to feel seamless, you know, to feel that everything flows, that to feel that everything is in one sequence shot. But in fact, there is so many technical challenges that we had to face. For instance, when you are in a POV shot, and if you want to look at yourself in a mirror,
right,
how you do that? Because you're going to see the camera. So, you know, we ended up building a second bathroom. And in fact, it's not a mirror that you see. It's an empty hole. And in the first bathroom, there is the camera, you know, that's filming the POV of Sue. And Margaret is, in fact, in the other bathroom and she synchronized her movements with the camera. So all this defining what we were going to film with the MiWiz shot and how many fake backs we would need, you know, to shoot all the deformation, all the back opening, the arm going outside. So everything was very precisely storyboarded. And it was one of the scenes that I had in my head in the most detailed way. So I knew exactly what I would wanted to film. And if you don't see like the leg of Elizabeth in some shot, you don't build that part in prosthetic, because building a prosthetic is so expensive that, you know, we need to manage the constraints of that.
You talk about it being so detailed in your head. When you're writing it, are you writing it in French or in English or both?
Both. Yeah. So basically the way I work, so it's the same. I really let come in the page what comes. So some things come in English. Most of the dialogues come in English. Some of the description as well, you know, but when it becomes more, you know, elaborate descriptions, because I write a lot of description.
Yeah.
This most of the time comes in French in a very elaborate way, which I love. And so this, when it comes in French, I let it come in French, and then I work with a translator to, you know, translate it into English. But at the beginning, it's really, yes, what we call franglais. It's like a mix of French, English, which, yeah, give the vibes, you know, of the script as well.
That's amazing. So knowing that, especially with a scene like that, how crucial it is to the film and where it's headed, we need to talk about Demi Moore. What were those conversations like of both pitching this project to her, but also letting her really have a sense of what you were going to be asking of her in this performance?
When I was writing, you know, I knew that the casting process was going to be very challenging, because I really wanted to best symbolize my story, to be able to work with what you call a star, you know, which represents in herself the fact that you live under the public eye. You, you know, take part of your words because you're looked at. But I knew that it was basically going to confront an actress to probably her worst fear, you know. So I knew I was going to have a lot of no's in the process, which happened, right, you know. And the name of the me, you know, arrived in the conversation. And I said, oh, wow, that's a great idea. But let's not lose too much time with that, because I'm sure she will never want to do something like that. You know, I had this image of her extremely in control of her image or appearance. And I said, I don't think it's realistic to, you know, think she's going to do that. But I said, let's send the script. We'll see. But, you know, let's not wait too long. And it turns out that she clicked instantly on the script. Like she really had a very strong reaction. So we met in Paris, and for me, the most important thing was, as you say, to explain her extremely precisely what the film was going to be. Because I knew that, you know, the movie is really a vision that expresses itself in a certain way that makes the whole building work. And if you change something, it unbalances everything, you know, things are taking shape to kind of explode on the way. And I knew she had never been in such a genre film, you know, with that. It was, so I wanted her to have all the elements, you know, with her, to be sure that, you know, we wanted both of us to jump into the same boat. So I took a lot of time discussing with her. Not so much about the story and the scene, because I think it was the thing that was crystal clear for us, that we both had lived in our lives in different ways. But this, I think, was, you know, didn't need further explanation. It was something that truly resonated for both of us. But I spent a lot of time discussing with her about everything else, you know, the visual world of the film. I shared with her a lot of visuals, you know, a lot of references, a lot of sound, discussing with her also all the technical challenges, you know, that were going to come into account on the shooting, because, you know, those define the way you're going to shoot. And for her, of course, what she's going to have to deal with performance-wise, you know, because also I work in an totally untraditional way. I don't do like a master and then I do a close-up. I really build my filmmaking on a very specific way of, you know, focusing on the shots that are the most important and that I need to spend the most time with. And so it can be sometimes unsettling because it's a little bit of different process. So I needed to share all that, all the technical elements of camera work, of, you know, what I was explaining, everything else in addition to the performance that builds the world and the performance. Because in that film, location, visual, they are truly characters in the film. You know, they express the inner world of the characters. They are mental projection, you know, of what the character goes through. So, you know, we also, of course, discuss about the prosthetic, the fact that it was going to imply so many long hours in the chair. It's going to imply a lot of constraint on the schedule, that we have to shoot maybe not in continuity, you know, to work depending on what the prosthetic needs. And of course, we discussed about the nudity, because for me, the nudity was a real tool of telling the story. The nudity has a real meaning, and it has a meaning when it's with Elizabeth, and it has another meaning when it's with Sue. And I wanted to explain each shot that I wanted to film and to explain what was the meaning of each shot. And in parallel, I also read her book, you know, that her autobiography, and I really discovered another side of her that I didn't know at all, that, you know, she had been taking many risks in her life. You know, she had been thinking out of the box. She had done many kind of avant-garde, provocative choice, you know, ahead of her time. And all this made me understand that, okay, I think Demi has what it takes, you know, to go into the risk that this story needs.
I'm curious about the prosthetic part of it in particular for both Demi and Margaret. They are in hair and makeup and doing the prosthetics for 6 hours. And then they're on set. Maybe they can't hear because of it. It could be restricting. It could be frustrating, I imagine. What did that sort of require of you in terms of connecting with them and figuring out how to direct them in these moments where it maybe required a little bit more finesse?
It was a very key aspect of the process. And one interesting thing about that is you can't know in advance how someone is going to react to the prosthetics. That's something, that's the first thing the prosthetic artist told me. He told me, you know, they can be willing to do it and super happy to do it, but until they have the prosthetic on their face, you don't know how they're going to react. And so, and that's exactly what happened. You know, like, for instance, I know that Demi, she loved working with a prosthetic. For her, it was something that was building her character. And so, you know, the 7-8 hours in the chair was almost as if it was her prep time as an actor to literally start to build her character at different stages. Also because, you know, when you have 6 hours of makeup, then you just have 2 to 3 hours to actually do the scene. So, you know, it's very challenging because, you know, you have to find your character for the first time because you can't rehearse with prosthetic. It's so expensive that the day you apply it, you have to shoot with it and then it destroys. So if you shoot another day, you have to build a prosthetic all over again. So I think it's stressful, but it also brings something that is a tension that you have to deliver. And so it was scary. I know that for both Demi and I, for those big, you know, Gollum moments or when it's so impressive, you have little time. So you know that you can't miss. So at the same time, it's stressful, but I think it brings something that goes out of you that you have to, you know, that you have to do. And for Margaret, it was very different because it turned out that, and we didn't know, she didn't know, I didn't know that Margaret, she really didn't like at all the prosthetic. For her, it was very almost claustrophobic. It was working in a bit different way. First of all, trying to, you know, limitate everything we had to have with Margaret with prosthetic, and also do things that we could do with the body doubles, you know, so we limit the time that we need to have things with her. I loved also the fact that even if she hated the prosthetic, there is this kind of actor instinct when she felt that her performance was in danger or was not as good as, you know, what she could do. Even if she hated it, she wanted to do another take, you know. This is, to me, the beauty of the commitment, you know, to performance when she was in the monster. And it's the moment where people pushes her on the floor and she falls down and she cries saying, it's me, it's still me. I remember, like, this scene, she was tired, you know, and at some point I say, okay, so let's do a last one, and I think it's okay. And after we did the last one, she wanted to do another one because she felt it was such an important moment, you know. It was such an emotional moment. And I think it was beautiful because even if for her it was very painful and difficult, the performance was the most important, and she stayed committed, you know, to that. And I think that's the beauty, you know, of actors, that, you know, they are committed to their parts.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes for a very striking end to the film. And it's, I won't spoil it so people can watch it, but I want to thank you for taking the time. I'm really sorry that our, you know, color palette here is not as striking as your film. I'm sure we'll add some noise to make it sound really crackling. The fire's really crackling. Thank you so much for your time.
It was great to see you.
After the break, Mark's interview with the brutalist filmmaker, Brady Corbet.
Welcome back to the Envelope Podcast. I'm Mark Olson. I'm here today with Brady Corbet, director and co-writer of The Brutalist. Brady, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And now we're having this conversation. It's February 2025. Barely 6 months ago, the film premiered at the Venice International Film Festival without a U.S. distributor, and now here we are. It's nominated for 10 Academy Awards. What are these last few months, what has this period of time been like for you?
It's mostly been exhausting. You know, I think that what I'm looking forward to is having, you know, some time to catch my breath and reflect on all this. I mean, it was such a marathon. Every part of the process was a marathon. Shooting the film was a marathon. The post-production process was a marathon for, you know, a variety of technical reasons, also because of the length of the film. The film takes up so much space, you know, that everything, you know, was a conflict. I mean, in terms of, you know, how much time we had originally, you know, planned for the mix, how much time we had planned initially for the grade. And because you're essentially grading and mixing two movies, not one, of course, that's a very different sort of metric. And so it was complicated. And then also just, you know, the sort of stress of getting the prints to Venice on time and through customs and then finally, it was just a lot. Yeah. And so I feel like it's been a really long, long run. And I'm looking forward just to having, you know, a bit of normalcy, you know, again, and some time with my daughter.
Well, considering the movie did take 7 years to make, has these last few months felt a part of that continuum? Or was it almost like there was a reset and this is like some whole new experience?
It feels like the same thing. No, that's a good question. I mean, that's what I mean. I think that because it was this continuum, I haven't had the chance to really, you know, have the perspective to appreciate it. I mean, there have been a couple of moments, and you know, especially, you know, at the Golden Globes when I was there with my 10-year-old girl. You know, that was like incredibly moving, mm-hmm. and to be able to share that has been amazing. But you know, I'm mostly on the road on my own, and so it's a gauntlet.
It is wild to me that while you've been promoting The Brutalist, been finishing The Brutalist, you and Mona Fastfold, your partner in life and filmmaking,
have a whole other movie that you've also been working on, a musical about the Shakers. Like, how is that even possible?
Well, yeah, I left that part out. That's true. We shot a film this summer that was very, very challenging for a variety of reasons. It's all set in the 18th century. You know, there's hundreds of dancers and most scenes and sequences in the film. It happened to be the hottest summer on record in Hungary where we were shooting. So it was like, you know, I mean, it was north of 38 degrees Celsius or something. So it was, you know, in the 90s and mm-hmm. hundreds for the whole shoot. And the dancers, because they were, you know, cloaked in so much fabric and stuff, I mean, it was just really, really brutal. So I was shooting second unit during the day for Mona and producing the film for her along with our partners. And then I would go home at night and I'd work on post remotely on The Brutalist. And then sometimes I would travel to either London or Paris for, you know, a final mix day, our 70 millimeter test, which were done at the Cinémathèque Française. And it's just been pretty full on.
And now tell me more about your collaborations with Mona. When the two of you are writing a project, do you know from the start, like, which one of you is going to be directing that project? How does that process work?
It's a good question. Yes, definitely. We're writing something for her. We're writing something for me. Or, you know, we also write for other people, too. So, which is an interesting thing. We like working for other people. I mean, I think that, of course, the two of us know each other so well that it's, you know, it's easy for us to sort of anticipate what, you know, what the other one is maybe chasing after. And so we're not very dogmatic about it. I mean, sometimes we write together, sometimes I usually work at night, and she's like a very early riser. So, I mean, sometimes I'll just like leave something on the table for her, and then she'll look at it over breakfast or something. So it's pretty loose. Long before we had a child together or anything, we were friends for years, and we worked together. So I think that if we had, you know, become a couple and then started to try to work together, the dynamic would be different. But because we worked together first, that we've always sort of reverted back to that same way of functioning. Writing is like, it's an improvisational process. Mm-hmm. I mean, essentially, you know, you sort of have a pretty good sense of you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end at the beginning of that process. But, you know, so much of the sort of sinew or the connective tissue between scenes and sequences comes from a process of yes and, yes and, yes and, which is the first rule of improv. Mm-hmm. You never shut anyone's idea down. You just are constantly taking it in different directions. Mm-hmm. And then I think that there's maybe a more important part of the process, the most important part of the process, which is really just talking about a project, you know, in terms of its philosophy. Mm-hmm. What is it really about? Something I struggle with a lot is that there are a lot of contemporary films and novels as well, to a certain extent, that for me, I just sort of, I know what they are in the first 5 to 10 minutes, and they continue to be that, you know, until the credits roll. But I they don't really transcend for me as a viewer. For me, I need films to be about a lot, and because they're so difficult to make any way you slice it. But even if you're, you know, making lighthearted fare, you know, that is like, you know, for like the teenage demographic or whatever, people, they're still suffering mm-hmm. to bring that work, you know, to life. And so I think, you know, it's so difficult no matter what, that you might as well really, you know, it really should be for something.
Well, you've been really open about the fact that The Brutalist in part was inspired by the experience of making your previous film, Vox Lux, and the idea of an architect also being someone who has to marshal a lot of money, a lot of people, just a lot of forces to create their work. They're not just painting in a garret on their own.
Sure.
Can you talk a little bit about how, to you, the movie is in some way an allegory of filmmaking?
Just for clarity's sake, because of the fact that the film is obviously, you know, it's first and foremost about post-war psychology and post-war architecture, the way in which those two things are intrinsically linked. It's about a post-traumatic generation, which every film I've made is sort of chronicling. So, I mean, The Childhood of a Leader was about the interwar period between, you know, the signing of the Treaty of Versailles and the Second World War. With Vox, it was a film about post-Columbine, post-9/11, you know, America, and sort of how America has metabolized that. And this film is about, you know, the 1950s, which is an era that especially the conservative agenda in this country especially really romanticizes. It's a time that a lot of folks seem to want to get back to. And so I wanted to really investigate that. As soon as I started working on a film about an architect, it was easy for me to relate to what, you know, his or her circumstances might be. So we imbued it with, you know, direct quotes, you know, from our own life and experiences, and you know, there are a lot of Easter eggs in the film for the people that you know they're intended for.
Like what?
they know, but you know, no matter what you work on, it ends up, of course, being personal at some point, and I mean, even Vox was a film that I felt really personally connected to, because I watched a lot of people as a young man become public figures at a young age. I myself became something of a public figure at a young age and didn't love it. Like, was not. I resisted it, and so I empathize a lot with this character, who is admittedly abrasive, but like I still empathize with her. So I think that, you know, but Mona and I, with this, I think because the film is also about a relationship, and we wanted it to feel like something that we recognized in a relationship, which was, you know, to take sort of the tropes of, you know, the 1950s melodrama and subvert them a little bit. And so, you know, they're constantly sort of insulting each other, and the relationship is not what you expect after, you know, anticipating Felicity's character's arrival. And I like that. I was thinking about relationships between, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, and this kind of the dynamic between, you know, like an intellectual couple of a certain era.
But also, you don't necessarily make it easy on yourself. Like, you've got the film has a certain scale and ambition to it, a scope. You're shooting in this somewhat outmoded format of VistaVision. You have a limited budget, a limited number of days. Do you feel like you could have made this easier on yourself? Like, it didn't have to be as, like, why do you think you make it so hard on yourself?
Because I just don't think you would be very good otherwise. I think it's so difficult, no matter how you slice it, that you might as well be fighting for something. And, you know, it's the accumulation of many of, you know, many of these choices that sort of make the piece what it is. And I felt that if we didn't shoot on this format, you know, that was, you know, because all these things are linked, right? Like, VistaVision was engineered in the early 1950s. It came about, it might have even come about the exact same year that the term brutalism was coined, and those first buildings were erected in the UK in the early 1950s. They're guided by a poetic logic. And even though I don't expect audiences to know these things or even literally interpret them, I do think that all audiences feel these things, and there's a sort of aura about them, and there's, you know, I think that that's what I yearn for in the medium. It's like music, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how many lyrics, you know, do you sing to yourself in a car and you don't know precisely what they mean? But somehow, you know, I mean, like, if you're listening to Ultravox, you know, what is the significance of Vienna precisely? I'm not sure, but it seems very important to them. And it's transcendent. Mm-hmm. And so what happens with cinema is that there's so many cooks in the kitchen that everything becomes very land of the literal. Like, mm-hmm. you have to defend, you know, why and, you know, would they and all of... And I'm like, well, I'm not guided by this very, very literal logic. I'm guided by something else. And I think that, you know, I don't make docudramas. I don't make neorealistic, you know, movies. I like them very much. I mean, there's many, you know, neorealist films that are very important to me. But, you know, there's a lot of choices in this film that, you know, I thought to myself, well, how would Michael Powell handle it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, if with the same screenplay, you know, like, how, and which is to say that, for example, like, Guy Pearce's character in the film is a character. Like, he's a capital A antagonist. Mm-hmm. That, you know, would have existed inside, you know, it could have been a James Mason or a Joseph Cotton, you know, and so, you know, I what was so great is the guy really understood that. Like, he was, you know, he imbued the character with nuance, but he understood that for an antagonist in a 1950s melodrama, that, you know, that it was okay for him to play that note and play it very well, very consistently, but over and over again in a way that really adheres to the style of performance from that time. And so, I don't know. I think that I think it's just a very important to have a philosophy about every aspect of the film, the mm-hmm. the performance, the music, the for all of these things to sort of be simpatico. And still, it might not result in something that everyone you know connects with, but there's a real consistency and continuity of a vision that kind of forges the thing into being and gives it its form.
But in the film, something like, say, Guy's character, the way he sort of just disappears from the movie in a somewhat unexplained fashion, is that what the kind of thing where you then have to fight to hold on to the enigma and the ambiguity of that? Like, are you being asked to, like, well, what happened to him?
I think that the whole idea was that there's all of these characters in the film that keep disappearing from this character's life. So, you know, it happens first with this character that, you know, Adrian, he steps out on the deck of the ship before they see the Statue of Liberty. And this character that he's, you know, holding in his arms is clearly been important to him for at least the last couple of years. That he's, you know, taken the boat over from Bremerhaven. And then he leaves him on a bus. And the last person you see before the title is this character and holds on him for a moment. He actually looks in the camera, which I thought was really interesting, because we never see him again. And then, you know, with Alessandro Nivola's character, at a certain point he disappears, and all these characters just kind of keep slipping away. And it's sort of about, the whole film is sort of about the transience and the transient nature of, you know, being an immigrant, about life on the road, and that you just keep everything that is important to you, near and dear to you, you just keep losing it over and over again, and or keeps being taken from you. And then, you know, so it made sense to me that it's not only Guy that more or less, you know, disappears from the story. It's also Adrian. I mean, we don't, you know, at a certain point, it starts to shift its focus to Felicity's character and ultimately to, you know, Jafia, their niece. And the reason that is because for me, the film, as it investigates legacy, this character's body of work is not his legacy. His family is his legacy. The road that he's paved for his niece, you know, alongside his wife, that is his legacy. That's the destination. And so I think that when Felicity sort of, for lack of a better turn of phrase, calls Guy's character out. I think that he's just sort of robbed of any of the power that he once held over them and the and the family. And so it kind of doesn't matter where he went. Like, he could have just gone on a long walk. But obviously there's cause for concern, and the way that Joe Alwyn's character responds seems to validate perhaps her accusation. So I think that everyone in the family is protecting some sort of a secret, and they're at least very concerned that he's hurt himself.
Hmm.
But I wasn't interested in seeing, a pair of legs dangling from the ceiling, and I wasn't interested in catching up with him on a long walk, because he doesn't matter anymore. He's served his dramatic purpose, and then the film shifts focus to the characters that actually the movie has been about the entire time.
Mm.
Because the movie opens with Jafia, and it closes with Jafia, because it's not about, male ego it's an investigation of that to some extent, but the only reason that the character, the characters are written to their circumstance. The character is a middle-aged man, because it was predominantly middle-aged men that were architects in the 1940s and 50s.
Mm-hmm. I know all three of your films grapple with real history and sort of like things that we actually know in the world, but then kind of warp them in some way, like use them to a dramatic effect. Do you see these films as like some version of like an alternate history? Or like I'm just so fascinated by like the relationship of these movies to like the world that we know.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I think A Virtual History is a slightly more honest contract with the audience, because once you start writing, it all becomes fiction. And I don't, there was a sort of, I've spoken about this a lot over the years, but there was a moment when I was a teenager and I was reading a biography, like a David McCullough biography or something, and there was just this moment when I realized, like, there's no way that anyone could know this. It's supported by years of research, and that's David McCullough, for example, is a genius, but it's like it is a story, and history is something that I all the time I never ever read interviews with myself ever, because I would always be frustrated by the one word that was left out, which was for me, which gives all of that context. Mm-hmm. Right. So even when you're if you are like looking through the documents from the trial of Joan of Arc or something, I'm sure that there's occasionally context missing from. So there was just this moment when I realized that the only way that I could make a historical picture was really to embrace it being a work of fiction. Mm. I went to an architectural consultant named Jean-Louis Cohen, who is an extraordinary. Sadly, he passed away recently, but he had written the book on Corbusier. He wrote Architecture in Uniform, which is a film about post-war psychology and post-war architecture. And I went to him with one question, which was, I've written this screenplay. I want you to take a look at it to make sure that it doesn't overlap too much with anyone that actually, exists. And because I was like, to my knowledge, there are no architects that got stuck in the quagmire of the Second World War. Certainly architects that, out of the Bauhaus that survived the camps and then were able to go on to have, any sort of career in the mid-century. And I left him with that question for a few days. He got back to me and he said, there are zero examples. There are zero. There's zero. And I found that incredibly disturbing. But it validated what, my initial impression. So, the way that I thought about the film was when we went to the Bauhaus archives and we looked at all of the unrealized propositions and blueprints, from architects that did not have the status that people like Marcel Breuer had, where Walter Gropius was able to get them positions in the 1930s at universities and stuff. The reality is that, 95% of those visionaries, that not only did they lose, you know, many of them lose their lives, but all of them lost their livelihoods, and that this film could somehow serve as a monument to the past and a monument to their unrealized work. This is sort of the poetic logic of the whole thing. And the way that I think about the film, and actually the way that Daniel Lipskin recently, the extraordinary, you know, architect who's designed many memorials, recently he wrote about the film. And you know, it was sent to me, and I was extremely moved by it because it was certainly the one interpretation of the film thus far that was the most in step with what we actually intended.
Hmm. Epilogue of the film, the character of Zofia Laszlo's niece, gives this speech where she, to some extent, explains the meaning of his work. And I can't help but wonder, like, is that her saying something that he told her, or is she in some way interpreting his work as a critic?
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, it's, you know, they're works of public art, just like the film. And so, you know, I really, really encourage audiences to interpret that because however they might, because I think that, you know, I think that art is interpreted and misinterpreted all the time. And so it's certainly a reading of, you know, what it is that he intended. You know, but there's a sort of bluntness about the film's conclusion, especially in a film that is, I'm interested in the dissemination of information when a film can be, you know, very, very direct, and at which points the film can be quite enigmatic. And I think that there's something kind of great, I think, for viewers, or hopefully it's great for, you know, most viewers, that they just never have the film's number. Like, they never really have the rabbit by the foot. And I think that disorientation, it keeps the experience of watching the movie very alive for viewers. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I think that some, you know, I mean, a critical analysis of it would be that you know, the filmmakers completely lost the plot, like it's a runaway train. But what if it's designed to be a runaway train? And that's so a place that I've been operating for a long time. Like, I like a film to sort of at a certain point become untethered by design. And I think that, you know, a lot of really interesting things happen for the viewer, and it can be frustrating, it can be exciting, it can be all these things at once. And so I think it's important that the film, you know, I don't make films to be universally loathed, but I don't make them to be universally liked either. There has to be some sort of tug of war. I hope that, you know, couples are like in the taxi ride home arguing about it.
And now there's been some controversy around the film from the use of AI in sort of correcting the Hungarian pronunciation of some of the performers. Have you been surprised by what the response has been to the use of that technology?
Yeah, totally. Because, I mean, it wasn't, you know, a surprise for us. Like, we were like, you know, it's funny to me because so many, you know, production companies make companies like our partners at ReSpeecher sign NDAs. Mm-hmm. Because of how this being such a hot button topic. But for us, it was obviously the only way for us to achieve something which was completely authentic. And for us, representation and representing the nation of Hungary was incredibly important to us. So I wanted Hungarian viewers to be able to watch the film and the Hungarian dialogue for it to be completely accurate. Because, you know, you could practice the language for 45 years and you would never speak it without, you know, an American accent, or in Felicity's case, an English accent. It's simply not possible. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most difficult languages in the world. And so, you know, for me, you know, I think that there is an absolutely ethical use of this technology, and that ReSpeecher in particular, a company that's based in Kiev, Ukraine, a group of engineers that worked on this, you know, in a manual fashion. I mean, this is us, you know, lining up sine waves, Minority Report style, and sort of seeing where like a vowel or a syllable is sort of falling out of place and giving, you know, the actor's accent away. It took us weeks and weeks to do, and it created jobs. It didn't eliminate jobs. And finally, you know, Adrian and Felicity, they own their vocal models in perpetuity, which is what, you know, when we did this, I said, you know, I want you guys to have this so that if there ever is a copyright infringement issue for you in the future, that you actually own it. And so I think people are, I understand why people are concerned. I have some of those concerns as well, but I think that people are not clear on exactly what we did and how we did it. The last thing I'd like to say about it is that there's been a lot of confusion about the dialect. And I think there was, you know, confusion about where we used it in the film. It's only used for off-screen Hungarian dialogue, you know, the monologues, the letters, etc. Like, that's it. We didn't use it for Felicity's accent when she's speaking English, or Adrian's accent when he's speaking English. His, you know, family is from Hungary. He can actually speak Hungarian, and we never would have been able to actually get it there if he didn't speak it as well as he spoke it. So, you know, it's been just another wave in the ocean of the last 6 months, but it is what it is, and I frankly, I would never have done it any other way. My daughter and I were watching North by Northwest, and there's a sequence and at the UN. And my daughter is half Norwegian, and two characters are speaking to each other in Norwegian. My daughter said, they're speaking gibberish. And I think that, you know, that's how we used to paint people brown, right? And, you know, I think that for me, that's a lot more offensive than using innovative technology and really brilliant engineers to help us make something perfect.
Before I let you go, one last thing I want to ask you is, you mentioned this earlier. At the Golden Globes, there was such a wonderful moment where you were speaking to your daughter from the stage. She was in the audience. She was crying. She later came up on stage with you. I can only imagine what has it been like for you to be experiencing this award season, the response to the film, in part through her eyes, to have her sort of along with you while this is all going on?
Well, I got back to the table, and she doesn't cry very much. She's been through a lot, actually, in the last few years, had some, you know, scary family stuff and whatever, and she's usually pretty stoic. So I got back to the table, and I was like, are you okay? And she just said, I'm just so happy it's finally over. And I was like, oh no. Well, it's not quite over. So I was like, I had to sort of contextualize that it was going to be another couple of months. But I was like, yes, it's sort of a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
But now we have 2 weeks left, and she's coming with me everywhere. So I've been away from her for the last 3 weeks. I return home to New York, pick her up. We go to the BAFTAs together this weekend, and then we have the Academy Awards, and then it's over. And the thing is that whatever the outcome of these things, it's really great. I wrote to Sean Baker last night to congratulate them on the DGA and PGA wins, because I was like, you know, what's so nice about the season is that a lot of folks have been getting their flowers. And I love Sean's movie, and I love Ramel Ross's movie. Like, I think Ramel is really a visionary, and it's a very important, you know, movie for many, many reasons. So I just, the fact that all of us have gotten this kind of lift from this attention, you know, it's really, I think we're all really grateful for it. I mean, the film's made almost $25 million now globally. And for a film that is about what this is about, that's 3.5 hours long, I mean, what more could you ask for? And so I'm not just being, you know, nice when I say that we've already won, and we got what we needed to out of this process. We've squeezed all the juice out of the orange. So I'm really grateful to, you know, like, our partners, because the thing that no one sees is that there's an army of people, you know, that are making this all possible and navigating these campaigns. And, you know, it's own production, and it's its own art form, and it's something that I don't do. Mm. And so it's been really interesting for me, and I've got to say I'm pretty impressed by our teams, you know, at A24 and Universal International. Like they know what they're doing.
Mm. The film, of course, is The Brutalist. Brady Corbet, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, my friend. I appreciate it.
In our next episode, for the finale of this Oscar season, Vaughn will be talking with Colin Domingo from Sing Sing.